This is Cynthia McKinney, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio.
I'm Arianna Huffington, and when I'm in the Bay, I keep it locked to Hard Knock Radio.
Hey, check this out, y'all. This is Zion 9. Right now, you're listening to
Hard Knock Radio, the Bay Area's finest in real hip-hop. Big up yourself. We'll never get out, chill, but we don't care. Keep my mind up there, high above all the noise and pollution. The shooting, the robbing, and looting in the mind. Prostitution got a problem, sucker, that y'all can't solve. Looking deep into my mirror, let the thoughts revolve. Like we in orbit on the dark side of the moon. I can't ignore it, the second coming probably soon. Every day as I lay, get in tune with the boom. The pain relief is to croon, trapped inside of my room. But my mind go free, so the galaxy bloom. Like my mama told me, pray the greatest to jewels. Picture me rolling out, I'm holding. Take control of the script. Off my back, spread my wings. My spirit can live.
Allowing me to sing what was never said. Parents look down on the pigeons who comb the streets for old trash to eat. But my head's up, I strut through this buzz. My beak doesn't repeat my master's speech. My feathers are your scholar's ink pen. They're how the natives decorate their big men. I represent strength and wisdom, and even you can see freedom ring when my wings spread. What is it about you that you have to capture? That which you cannot master. If you can't grasp it, you attack it, trap it, slam it in a cage and latch it. Every day that you hold me in bars is another day I can't teach your soul to soar. Hear both of us are linked to the song, and when you hear a caged bird, sing along, sing along, sing along.
D Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Been wanting to talk to these two folks for a minute. They have put out a book. It is called Inflame, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. It is written by Raj Patel, who is a New York Times bestselling author for the book, The Value of Nothing. And it is also written by Rupa Meyer, who we all know and love. She's been on our show tons of times. She is one of our go-to physicians that we talk to, even before there was a pandemic. And so she's with USF. She's the co-founder of the Do No Harm Coalition. And so they've written a book that is timely and I think will be of use, you know, for the years to come. They're looking at the concept of inflammation and talking about how we have to have the deep medicine of decolonization. So welcome to the show, you two. Glad to have you on. And before we even get into the book, I'm going to have to kind of, you know, take advantage of you being on here and go for the jugular. You know, I got a notice this morning that is talking about we now have a COVID outbreak at one of the schools in Oakland. In fact, let me just look at it right now, because that was crazy. It's the Montclair school community talking about, hey, there's an outbreak and some of the kids are gonna have to go home and be out of class for 10 days. On the surface, it may seem like that's not so bad, but we have parents right here that are demanding that kids go to school and not wear masks. We've had fistfights in other school districts around this. And we have people that say, come hell or high water, do not close these schools. And in many ways, you have folks that have taken a mindset that, hey, there's going to be collateral damage. You know, it's only 1 or 2%, you know, and 1 or 2% die anyway. So what's the big deal? How do we start to just look at this whole COVID situation, some of the responses to it, and especially as schools are opening this week and they started opening last week, and here we have an outbreak with people who have dug in their heels and say, it's no big deal.
This is the heart of the question that we get at in our book, DVD, and this whole year in writing this book, which has been so challenging in the midst of the wildfires and running away from the smoke and the protests, ongoing protests around police violence and the sweeping up of our unhoused brothers and sisters in the streets. It's just such a, you know, it all sort of culminates in this moment of back to school as our AQI is rising from the wildfires around us. Let's send the kids, millions of unvaccinated children, back into school in the face of this Delta variant where the, you know, cases are rising. And a vaccine is on the horizon and set for children. It's coming online. So why are we, after 20 months of being careful with our children, now, you know, sending? And, you know, this is really about looking at a culture that has structured itself on prioritizing the economy over everything else. So whether it's, you know, the inability to take the data around climate change and, you know, watch as our state burns now every year with these catastrophic fires and the drought, to take that data and to turn it into meaningful action urgently so that the lives of our children are not impacted by climate change, so that we can start mitigating some of the harmful effects. If we can't completely avoid them now, at least decrease the damage that's coming. The same thing with COVID. You know, all the data suggests that Delta is what we're seeing right now, more severe, because even with the percentage of people who are hospitalized per case rate right now is much higher than even our worst peak. So while we had 12 million people with COVID in the winter peak, we had 120,000 hospitalizations. And right now we have 64,000 hospitalizations with only 3 million cases. So you can see that we are seeing a different pattern with Delta, and there's a lot of unknowns. And in the face of those unknowns, we are sending children to school with masks and open windows as the plan, and maybe some fancy hospital level ventilation as a plan. When I go to the hospital, I am wearing an N95 mask. I wear a surgical mask over it. I wear a face shield over that. And I don't touch my PPE, where I don't touch my protective gear, until I leave the hospital to go write up my notes in a separate building. We're asking our children to be in masks with open windows in like 30 kids deep and a teacher in these classrooms, and I don't think it's appropriate. So what is the solution? I don't think that we should expect everyone to be able to stay home, although I do think that universal basic income would be appropriate about a year ago, so that people, if they wanted to make the decision to stay home and be with their children, they could. I think that distance learning should be an option until we're out of the woods, which is safely by the end of 2023, we'll have a better idea of where we're all going and whether or not vaccines are effective at preventing children from dying. The people who say, oh, 1 to 2%, you know, that's okay. Children should not be dying. School-age children should not have to die to go to school. We need to do everything we can to make that safe for them. And so, you know, I think that breaking up our school system into pods, hiring more teachers, allowing teachers, you know, to be in 5 to 6 person pods and paying them well through that experience. The teachers are also not exposed. And so I think that there's other systems and ways of doing this that would prioritize care over our economy, that would prioritize right. The care of our children. And so, sorry, that's a long-winded answer to this specific thing, but it really gets at the tenets of what our book is about, which is that our culture has been organized. We have walk around with these assumptions about what we're supposed to do that have been organized in a time of colonial conquest, where Black, Brown, first starting with our Indigenous Ohlone community here, were, you know, their culture is continues to be erased, as we see with the West Berkeley shell mounds that they're fighting to protect. The one of the oldest inhabited sites of the Bay Area, a part of our human heritage here. And that those systems that came with colonialism are systems that interrupted critical relationships of humans to each other and humans to the entire web of life.
Right. And well, let me stop there for a second, because I want to come back to that relations, and I don't want to cut you off, but I also don't want to leave what we started talking about, because this is, Rod, you can also weigh in as well. Two things come when we talk about relationships. It seems to me that we have political relationships with our kids. We have superficial relationships, like I'm a dad, let me walk with my kids. Oh, Dave's a good dad, you know, but do you spend time with your kids? You know, will you sacrifice for your kids? Will you take the necessary steps to ensure that the world would be a better place for your kids? And I'm saying this very pointedly because people love the kids, but the kids are the ones that are often sacrificed, you know? And in many communities, kids aren't even allowed to be kids after a certain age, as my kids are now, you know, becoming, you know, close to the, you know, 10 and 8 years old. My son is no longer looked at as a cute kid. He's now something else. You know, this black kid is not a kid in the eyes of some. He's expandable. He's not, you know, the cute, cuddly thing that we associate kids with. And I say this because as we're looking at this school reopening, I have a good friend who just so happens to be a very well-known reporter in Nevada. He has a four-year-old. His four-year-old was exposed to COVID, right? He winds up being the story. You could look it up. Four-year-old is exposed to COVID. He goes to the school. He says, look, the kid's been exposed. I want to keep her out, quarantine her for 10 days. What can we do to make sure that she stays on top? Well, we can't do anything. What do you mean you can't do anything? Well, she's, you know, can she do distance learning? No, she can unenroll from the school and go to another school. And, you know, when she gets better, then she comes back. But she's going to be behind. And it's like this crazy story, you know, where you're penalized for being sick and there's no accommodation in the middle of the pandemic. And basically what was pointed out in the article was that come hell or high water, your kids are going to go to the school and they're not going to take these, you know, the necessary precautions that you're prescribing. So they're political fodder. Nobody wants to be recalled. They want the money that comes in. Oh, that was the other thing. They said they can't afford to close the schools because every, you know, they need to have the bodies there. They need to make sure that they're counted so they can get this money. It's just like this wild story where, again, we say we love the kids, but the kids are only good to, you know, become a statistic so everybody can get money. Not to be long-winded, but we're finding this, not just in Oakland, but Nevada, New York, it repeats. Texas is even crazier. You know, I could go on and on about that, where, you know, people are dying and they're just completely covering it up. So this kind of comes to this point about relationships. It seems like the fundamental relationship of, you know, parents to kids and all that has been broken irreparably.
Living here in Texas, you know.
You're in Texas.
I am in Texas.
You know.
I mean, yeah, we're living through the real culmination of this moment where we see who's disposable and who isn't, yeah. Who gets to be sacrificed in order that the wheels of the economy, well oiled as they are here in Texas by oil, continue to turn. And so, yes, you know, it is black and brown bodies that are, you know, put in the front line. Look at the places that were COVID hotspots at the out, you know, the start of the outbreak here in Texas. It was prisons and slaughterhouses, right? Mm-hmm. You know, places where, again, there are certain kinds of lives that can be sacrificed in order that other kinds of lives flourish. And you're entirely right. I mean, you know, David, if we are sacrificing our children so that we can carry on and try and pretend that things are normal, that the rules that we've set up, which only fund schools if there are bodies there, will turn those bodies into dead ones through the operation of this, again, the sort of economistic thinking. But that thinking of like who gets to think, who gets to feel, who is worthwhile and who is a threat, right, in a supremacist society, is precisely what it is that isn't new about America. It isn't new about capitalism. And inflamed, you know, we're sort of tracing out the long history of how it is that certain bodies are committed to the flames, sometimes literally, sometimes to the flames of fever, sometimes to the ICU, because of what they look like and what purpose they serve in order to maintain certain kinds of capitalist right. white supremacy.
Real talk there. And I appreciate that. Rupert, let me come back to your point, because you were starting to go down and kind of break down this history. And we left off with you talking about relations. And it looks like in the book, a lot of it, metaphorically and quite literally, is talking about relations, starting with relationships to the body and the world around us, you know, to the way that we engage one another and the short and long-term impacts. But to Raj's point, it seems like the bottom line, at least for the last 400 years, is really a question of have and have nots economically, and who's expendable and who's not expendable, you know, physically speaking. So let's kind of pick up where you were leaving off, where we left off.
Yeah, well, so those relationships, those architectures of domination that were put in place through colonial society persist today, and they persist throughout our society, as we see with police violence, as we see with how we treat our unhoused community on the streets, as we see with the health outcomes from COVID, and we see with how Black and Brown people are treated once they enter the hospital. First, there's the distrust that people have to get over accessing healthcare. Then there are the barriers to access healthcare. Then there's the debt that's accumulated through accessing healthcare. So all of these things were put in place through, you know, hundreds of years ago. And what we've seen is that they all create damage. They create damage to our bodies, and it's written in the language of our cells and our molecular mediators. And the way in which that is translated into our bodies is through inflammation. Now, inflammation is the body's normal, healthy response to damage.
And inflammation, not information, right?
Inflammation, yes.
Inflamed, okay.
Yes, yeah. Inflamed. So when we hear about diseases of inflammation or inflammatory diseases, we now know that all of the diseases I treat in the hospital, what we call the bread and butter medicine cases. So the diabetes, the end-stage renal disease, the COPD and asthma, the heart attacks, the Alzheimer's, the cancer, all things that disproportionately burden Black, Brown, and poor communities. These diseases all have inflammation as a part of their pathways. And a certain kind of inflammation, a chronic smoldering inflammation. And what I was saying is that inflammation is the body's healthy way of responding to damage or the threat of damage. And usually when there's damage or the threat of damage that's acute, the inflammatory response is revved up, the damage goes away, and inflammation helps restore and heal whatever damage was created in the body. However, when the damage keeps on coming, as here in East Oakland with the ongoing assault of our air by the ABNI foundry, through the air pollution from the wildfires, through the police violence. It's not just the literal biological damage from, you know, a chemical pollutant. It's also the histories and narratives of colonial oppression, the erasure of our cultures, the over-policing or the policing of our neighborhoods, the traffic stops. All of these things are part of a set of exposures that imprint their way on the body. And the way that they are translated into our body is through inflammation. And so when we talk about police violence, and this is what we looked at with the justice study, looking at what happens when there's no justice for police killings, what is the impact of police killings on community? We found widespread trauma, no surprise. But what we know about trauma is that trauma is a major driver of inflammation in the body. And so you have to look at how trauma and ongoing trauma is contributing to the rates of diabetes and of heart disease in our communities. Right. And then you take something like COVID, which enters, and what you're seeing is that bodies that have been conditioned through social oppression, that have grown up through centuries of being oppressed, are responding to a insult like COVID, the presence of COVID, with profound, severe inflammation. It's as if our immune systems are being tuned over time to a hyper intense inflammatory response. So this is why when we talk about how do we address the pandemic, it's not simply masking and vaccination, which is helpful. Like, we should be masking, we should be vaccinating. But the real solutions is to dismantle the structures in our society that predispose us to this hyper-inflammatory state. And that is what we're talking about in the book, is to dismantle colonial capitalism and the worldview that made it possible to treat the water the way we did, to treat the indigenous people the way we do, to treat each other the way we do. And that we won't actually have an end game to this pandemic until we do that. And the same thing goes with climate change, which is useful because they're one in the same path. They're not easy, it's not an easy path, but these right. systemic derangements are being caused by the same phenomenon.
That's the voice of Rupa Mara. We also have Raj Patel. They've written a book called Inflamed. And we're looking at, you know, the, I want to say like a history of colonialism and how it relates to medicine and all this other stuff that we're dealing with day in and day out. Two questions that come to mind as you were talking. There's the argument that people say, look, we all adapt, you know, the strong will survive, you know, evolve or perish. And yeah, we live in a world where the soil isn't as healthy as my grandma's soil was down south. So what? I can drink. I can survive this soil. I can survive the soil from the former gas station across the street from me. You know, so if you want to grow vegetables, my body can take it. I can drink the water. It might not be the water that was from the springs that used to run here, but my bodies have now adapted. And there are people that have taken on the mindset of survival of the fittest. And if you can't survive in today's world that you call toxic, we got to thin the herd. How do we respond to that? Because that is a actual mindset that many people think. And maybe I'll start off with you, Raj, because you have a lieutenant governor, you know, Daniel Patrick, who pretty much said that, you know, pretty much said, like, this is our responsibility to step aside and, you know, and old people got to die off. And so everybody else can move on.
But, you know, one of the things we talk about in the book is how that kind of strain of thinking of survival of the fittest morphs very easily into eugenics, right? Into a kind of policing of whose body gets to survive. How do we make sure that it's only the whitest and the richest of people who are considered fit for survival, right? There's nothing natural about this idea of fitness. Fitness is something that is, as you say, right? It's dialectically related to your environment. And if that environment is itself racist, then who it is that gets to be deemed fit is inevitably a function of racism and white supremacy. So this idea of, oh, you know, we'll get by, we'll adapt, has everything to do in the end with the kinds of power that certain people have in society in the first place. So it's quite all right for Dan Patrick to say, oh yeah, you know, we'll just muddle it out. because he knows full well that in between him and his rich white friends are working class people and communities of people of color who will suffer and be sacrificed, like we were talking about our children being sacrificed, whose bodies are going to be the layer of insulation between the burn of inflammation and of COVID and the comfort of people like Dan Patrick here in Texas. It'll, you know, it's the working class and it's people of color. So, this idea of the survival of the fittest is a disingenuous way of masking a certain kind of colonial capitalism.
But many people who are victims to that, or once were, have adapted that too. I have people that are Black, brown, who say, brother, you know, I'm gonna survive. You know, I'm a survivor. We pride ourselves on that. So what happens when we adopt the mindset and even, you know, execute some of the very same practices that you all are dismantling and are trying to show another direction? How do we deal with that? Because yeah, there's a rich and there's a white part of it, but there's, you know, part of the reason that we have this pandemic to the degree that we have is we have some brown leaders in places like Brazil, places like India, who took on the same Trumptonian type of mindset, and was like, you know, some of y'all got to go. How do we deal with that?
Yeah, so exactly. And we're happy to throw Modi under the bus as well, because he exhibits the same horrific will to power and misunderstanding of life that really comes back to the Enlightenment, when, you know, Descartes and his acolytes were pushing this idea that somehow nature was separate from civilization. And we see that misconception continued in the, you know, white environmentalist movement, as if, you know, the environment is something out there and we are over here. We see that in, you know, science and medicine, with the separation of our anatomical systems, which is why we created our book like that, as a way to show, you know, these things are actually, you know, the mind is in the body. The mind is the body. That you have, your health is completely reliant on the millions of organisms that use you as a home. So who are you? And what is, you know, what does your identity mean then, if you would be useless without all these other creatures you can't even see or don't even know are there?
Right.
So I feel like this misunderstanding of who we are and this misunderstanding of what role we have to play in life is going to it is destroying the planet. And the only places on earth, Davey, where we're not seeing that happen are in cultures that are living in another cosmology. There are people who are living with an intact system of relationships to the web of life around them that ends up creating greater biodiversity around them and greater biodiversity inside them. And we know now that the microbes inside our body, the more biodiverse they are, you have a greater likelihood of resisting inflammatory disease.
Right.
So it's actually the mindset that that will make us healthy or unhealthy. Because the mindset will predicate everything that comes after it. Will you build a system that, you know, incarcerates our rivers and gives all the water in California, like 80% of our water goes to the most wasteful, poisonous agricultural techniques that not only poison the water, but damage the soil and poison the workers. And we haven't stopped to rethink that as our state is inflamed, as our state is literally up in flames. We haven't had a wholesale rethinking of California water and what we're doing. And that's, you know, this is what we're trying to advocate for, that we all need to get involved, and that this must be a revolution of care.
Right.
Where that mindset that you're talking about is put on the chopping block. And we say, like, that won't work for not only our health, but those people who are espousing those ideas, even people at the top of the pecking order, their health suffers when the web of life is completely sundered around them. And so Right. That is, you know, that is to the ineffectiveness of that mind view in supporting health is what we show. And the effectiveness of a different worldview in supporting health is what we demonstrate in this book, and that health can no longer be seen as an individual process or an individual plight, or even the plight of one group. It has to be a holistic enterprise where we are engaging with political systems, social systems, the way in which our water works, the way in which our energy is is gathered. Right. So all of these things need to come into another way, a more holistic and radical way of imagining the world.
You mentioned the word cosmology, and there's a term that you use. I think it's in the first chapter. What's that word? There's a phrase.
You're talking about a colonial cosmology. Cosmology, right. That's right. Yeah.
Can you all build up on that, or did you kind of explain that whole thing, Rupa, when you were speaking, or is there a deeper part to that? Because I know it's hard for me to look at my little notes.
Right.
you highlight them, and I'm like, I know I highlighted that, but now I have like a whole page full of yellow things, and I can't find it.
So Raj can take that deep dive.
So the idea here basically is that every civilization has ideas about, say, medicine and food being kind of the same thing. It's only this society where there are hierarchies between who's allowed to think and who's allowed to prescribe and who's allowed to say, this is how you treat yourself. And that's part of this bigger story of how some individuals in this world are part of society, other individuals are sort of part of nature, and we have a police that sits on the boundary that right. decides, okay, you're able to be part of society, you're not. And so in many other civilizations, animals are part of society. In many other civilizations, rivers and trees and landscapes and memories are part of that society. And part of capitalism's cosmology is to bring about this sort of thought police so that very few people can think and the ways that they think are governed by ideas of profit rather than right. of life.
Well, the thing that stood out for me when I saw that was the fact that, and we're probably going to do a show on this tomorrow with what's the sister's name? Michelle Lee, who did Working the Roots, right? Because what we had here, what stood out to me was the fact that in colonialism, as you describe in the book, one of the first things they did was dismantle all the practices of people. You know, like, let's get rid of the healers and the quote unquote medical folks that were there that were indigenous, and, you know, criminalize them, ridicule them, erase them, even as you're taking some of their techniques and methodology and then putting them into modern medicine. But we've been told that all that stuff needs to go out the window. And I don't know, maybe Rupa, because you are a doctor, is that a constant battle? Like, you know, grandma's ways of looking at the world is somehow savage. And the way that we look at the world today with modern medicine is, you know, civilized. And you kind of make the case in the book that it's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, there's so much wisdom that comes from our ancestries that keeps people healthy, that modern medicine doesn't really have a way of incorporating or understanding. That seems like common sense to a lot of us. And it's, I think that this goes to something that we talk about in the book, that, you know, modern medicine, because it's arranged through colonial architecture, only admitted certain kinds of voices into what is determined as science and therefore, you know, worthy of our consideration. So who gets to be the peer of peer-reviewed science is what we kind of take aim at, because there are other systems of knowing and knowledge that bring other science to the table that have been useful over centuries. You know, one of the things we talk about in the book is fecal transplants. So as the microbiome, as the gut microbiome, all the organisms that inhabit our intestines that provide us with their health conferring byproducts when they digest our food, the more the more diverse our gut are, it appears that the more capable our microbes are in turning down inflammation. And one disease we're seeing a rise in the last 20 years is Clostridium difficile, which is a life-threatening infection in the colon, which can come when, you know, you've had a round of antibiotics, your gut microbes are killed off, then C. diff can proliferate and then cause a terrible diarrhea. Life-threatening diarrhea can also cause something called toxic megacolon, which is a life-threatening.
Wow.
And so we're seeing rising rates of community acquired C. diff, and we're like, where is it coming from? And now we're learning it's probably coming from our food system, from the antibiotics that are being used in in the livestock to the fact that glyphosate, one of the biggest Roundup, weed killers that's used in agriculture, Roundup doesn't kill Clostridium in the soil, and Clostridium difficile is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. So are we actually cultivating these pathogenic strains in our soil, and they end up on our food and then in our body? Well, back in, you know, one of the interesting treatments for recurrent C. diff infections are fecal transplants, where you get the gut microbiome of someone who's healthy and you transplant it into someone's colon to repopulate their colon with a healthy ecosystem. And, right. You know, it's been effective in treating recurrent severe Clostridium difficile infection. Well, this is a treatment that comes from China, from like, I think it was 400 AD, they were doing this back in the day. And I think they called it yellow soup, where they would take the feces of someone who was healthy and make a soup. And if someone was suffering a severe diarrhea, they would give them the soup. And it was a treatment.
Was considered savage.
Oh, by the, oh my God, it was crazy. Yeah, that crazy Chinese medicine, right? And so it's interesting to see how these things are, you know, repackaged now as fecal transplant, or it's done through a, you know, nasogastric tube. So somehow it's more appropriate than, you know, what we see in, you know, back in the day in China. So I think that this is, you know, goes with the whole system of thought that perceives non-white, non-Western ideologies as somehow inferior or somehow less sophisticated or less peer-reviewed. Same thing goes with traditional ecological knowledge and the fire medicine of our California Native people, where, you know, when the colonizers came here, they thought this was this beautiful place. And, you know, these savage people didn't know what they were doing. They weren't using or capitalizing off of all these beaver and salmon and all the animals here.
Right. But yeah, talk about that. Yeah.
Right. But they were tending that. They were actually actively in relationship and tending the most thriving ecosystem on planet Earth, and with the greatest diversity of languages of any place in the Americas was right here in the Bay, right in this zone. And so there was amazing communities and relationships that supported this biodiversity. And part of that involved fire and fire medicine and knowing when to burn and what to burn and how to burn so that you wouldn't have these catastrophic fires. But when the, you know, white folks came here, they seen the fires and started removing the brown people from their pristine wilderness as if somehow people don't belong in these spaces. And that's another error of enlightenment thinking, that no, actually it's the people who made those spaces. So the ecological movement is full of this problem, as if somehow we can have ecological restoration without restoring all the land back to indigenous people and their systems of knowledge that kept them in ecological balance. Like, this is looking at the underpinnings of white supremacy in all levels of society. And so, you know, I think that we have to look at what medicines are out there that are powerful, effective, and have thousands of years of peer review to them, such as fire medicine here in California.
Or even, you know, inoculation. You know, I mean, Africans were doing inoculations or vaccines, as we call it today. So it's interesting to see, you know, that that history is lost, you know, and it's attributed to somebody else when we, in fact, were, you know, indigenous folks were practicing many of the things that are now, you know, housed by professionals who then will turn around and say, it's illegal for me or you to practice, you know, these long-term things. In fact, we put a law in the books, but then Big Pharma, somebody will remix that and practice it itself. Let me ask both of you this with respect to the book. And I'm glad we have, you know, Rupa Mara on and Raj Patel talking about their new book, Inflamed. You have about, 9-10 chapters in the book. Somebody picks this book up, kind of give them a rundown. Give them like 2 chapters from each of you that you want them to go and look at and say, look, I think if you read chapter 3, Digestive Systems, I want you to pick this out. You know, this is what I really want you to capture. So I'll start off with you, Raj. Give a couple of chapters that you want people to look at and kind of give us that 30-second cliff note that you want them to walk away with.
Well, that's so hard. I mean, but and we wrote it as a progression. So, you know, you kind of go through a bit of medicine boot camp at the beginning, and by the end of it, you're on top of things. But for me, certainly the introduction helps understand why we're talking about medicine in the ways that we are. Right. And right now, I think it's important, as the world is on fire and our lungs are a source of infection and also grief and also healing, to maybe have a look at the respiratory chapter to understand how fire in our lungs and in our air are deeply connected.
So that's chapter 4, the respiratory system. So you're going deep on that. You're going to pull out a lot. Somebody's calling me. Don't call me in the middle of this. Who the heck is calling me? Hold on a second. Give me 1 second. You know, it's rude to do that. You know, people see you online and then they like, oh yeah, don't call because you see somebody online. No, you don't do that. All right. So let's go to you, Rupa.
Which chapter?
Let's talk about deep medicine, making the whole body whole. That's chapter 9. What would we get out of that? And let's look at reproductive system, considering what's going on with reproductive rights all over the country at this point in time.
Yeah, I've just been thinking about how, with the reproductive chapter, looking at Afghani women, there's an activist I know who's out there right now who was setting up a school for girls who's trying to get out, and how they've been suffering through imperialism and patriarchy. For so many years, you know, and it's just one oppressor or the other. So it's just, my heart is really hurting right now for what's happening there. But the reproductive chapter is really timely in looking at how colonial systems of knowledge reproduce themselves through schooling. Why do we send our kids to school? Why were Indigenous people forced to send their kids to school? I remember at Standing Rock with LaDonna, listening to her stories. She passed away this last year. Listening to her stories of how when the government groups would come to Standing Rock Reservation, they would strap the children on the backs of dogs and force the dogs to run out into the prairie because they felt safer with the kids strapped on the backs of the dogs, the babies. Than in the presence of these, federal agents who are coming to remove the children from their Indigenous homes and put them in these boarding schools, which now the truth is coming out that all of these folks, so many of these schools, thousands and thousands of children.
Let's just stop for a second. I want people to kind of resonate with that for a minute. You know, we talk about American excellence and all this stuff, but that's an act of terror. You're walking in, whether you're talking about Australia, whether you're talking about some of the missionary practices throughout the continent on Africa, what happened throughout the Americas, and definitely here in the good old USA, of people walking in and going, Rupa, Raj, your kids are going to belong to us. We're going to take them and we're going to educate them so that they are no longer savage. I mean, that is an actual mindset that is translated into policy that now they don't want to have it be taught in schools. Like, we don't want you learning about this in school. Let's move on. You know, that was in the past. Move on, Rupa. Why are you writing a book about that? Move on, Raj. We don't need to know about that. But let's build on that, because that is so deep. And just hearing you say it, it's like, damn, like you took people's kids.
Well, they're still taking people's kids. Like, this is a colonial act of terror that's ongoing. They're still breaking up Black and Brown families, whether it's through the incarceration of, fathers, whether it's through the Border Patrol and what's happening with ICE. All of these systems still continue, and they're all connected, and they're all aimed at eroding the power of our families. And they absolutely need to stop. And what happened with our Indigenous communities here needs to be taught. And what's still happening right now is our communities are trying to shut down Line 3, the pipelines. The most effective form of addressing climate change is happening right now with our Indigenous people who've been fighting climate change for 600 years in this area. And so you know, the same happens in Germany with Holocaust denialism. And in fact, Hitler came, you know, looked at what we did, what the United States did to the indigenous people as a blueprint for what he wanted to do to the Jews and other undesirables, quote unquote, in Europe. And so for us to have a Holocaust museum to, you know, folks of Jewish ancestry and not really be studying the Holocaust, the genocide that has happened here and the tactics that continue to this day is unacceptable. That we need to wrangle with this history. We need to see how it's actually living today, not only in our current policies, but in our bodies, in the inflammation that is in our bodies. And so the reproductive chapter was the hardest one for me to write. As a woman, we look at, you know, the toxic history of, you know, violence towards women and how that is part of the colonial structure, the colonizing structure, which we see in Afghanistan.
Right.
And so that chapter, I think I had a headache every day. I sat down to work on it, to research it and write it. It literally took me the longest to work on because it was so hard. But now when I read it, I'm so grateful we wrote it the way that we did, because it makes that connection between women's reproductive worlds and the education of our children, the reproduction of colonial cosmologies and ideologies. And this is one of the main reasons why we are homeschooling our children this year, this last year. Our kids are very much excited to be learning in this way, but it also allows us to step outside of the school system and say, what do we want our children to be learning? How do we want them to be learning? From whom do we want them to be learning? And what are the values we want to center for our family? It's been hard. It's not easy. We've all had to rearrange our work lives and schedules and, our pocketbooks. But it's also opened a door for me personally to think about, as the world is burning, what do my children need to learn? You know, as California is on fire, what are the urgent lessons my kids need to learn? And are they being taught in school right now? No, they're not. They're really not. And so is the education that we're giving our children even relevant to the challenges that they're facing right now? I don't believe it is. And so how do we create communities of education, of educating our children that are safe and that really advance what they're going to be need to, what they need to come into to be able to do in 20 years from now? Because if we think things are bad right now, in 20 years from now, the challenges will be incredible. I don't think we can even imagine how bad.
And you don't want the kids to be in it, you know, going back to the reproductive chapter. What if they are reproduced to take on a survival of the fittest mindset and they become more draconian, right? There was a generation that would have never have thought to cut Medicare and to cut Social Security because there was a revering of the eldership. And with each passing generation, you know, you see it play out in a very gross way where folks are like, I need some money. Let's take that old lady's pocketbook, knock her over the head and steal it, right? Which is something that you wouldn't have seen, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But it also trickles up to policy where folks are like, let's pass, you know, let's not have any sort of protections for these elderly folks that are living in homes. They can be evicted. Didn't we evict a 100-year-old woman in San Francisco? Didn't we have those types of things? Or you can have a governor who gets applauded, as we did with Cuomo, while he was warehousing, you know, and hiding deaths in old age homes. It's all violent. We'll focus on one type, the person who knocks over somebody with the pocketbook and takes their money, and forget all the other violence that is being legislated or, you know, just being covered up and glossed over by the very same mediums that were focused on the pocketbook, but then, you know, ignore the COVID death in old age homes. And so I'm saying that to say that we may have a generation that shows up and, you know, and takes the position, hey, you're over 40. y'all got to go because there's not enough resources and ain't no community. It's about, you know, let's move you all out of here and just have this whole sort of, you know, dog eat dog type of mentality. That's what we may be reproducing. The ultimate capitalists.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's not like there's not enough resources. It's just that, you know, the reason that we evict the elderly or warehouse them is because it's more profitable to do it that way. There's more resources for a few people, right? And, you know, and it's just about this idea, this culture of greed and death that come together and which allow this, you know, this concentration of wealth to continue even, I mean, as we've seen through this pandemic, right? You know, the billionaires got richer and richer and yet we're seeing epidemic levels of hunger. Now, 2.2 billion people are food insecure around the planet at the same time as these billionaires are heading off to space. It's not an accident. This is part of how the system is set up.
Real talk. You know, I appreciate both of you coming on this afternoon. We're running out of time. That was the voice of Raj Patel, Rupa Mara. They wrote the book called In Flame. Let me make sure I got the whole title. In Flame, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. I want to make sure we have the full title there. You know, we appreciate the work that you did. Rupa, I just remember being at your spot when you were working on this. So you were, it's been what, 3 years in the making? Of just your involvement in this?
Yeah, at least I think 3 years with Raj.
Yeah.
Just thinking about it and brainstorming and sketching. But really the last year, I think the day I came home from my first big COVID shift, we sold the book and just knuckled down to write it. And man, that was a hard year.
Yeah. And then, you know, obviously, and as things are emerging, you know, the George Floyd protests, you know, elections, all kind of crazy things. There's that need to be like, oh, we got to go and add this. I know with me and Jeff, when we did our book, we were like, we got to add this other stuff.
Yeah, it just felt like as we were writing it, the world kept offering us further examples to further our thesis. So it just, you know, it's a timely book. I hope it offers everybody a way of understanding what's happening right now so we can get to real work. So I'm all for mitigating strategies. Let's, you know, do the little things we can right now to keep people safe, but let's go for the big transformative changes we need to keep us safe and to really cultivate a culture of care, because we can do this, but we can only do it together.
Real talk. We're gonna take a break. Here on Hard Knock Radio, want to thank Raj, want to thank Rupa. In Flame, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice is the name of the book. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Keep on working my job.